Governor Noem bans migrant children, bans proof of vaccine requirements, and says people are addicted to being offended. From SDPB Radio, it's Wednesday, April 21st, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we welcome the Dakota Political Junkies. We'll talk about Noem's rhetoric and policies, how they shape the nation's view of South Dakota, and how they shape how we see ourselves here at home. We talk about moral narratives and how they feed into toxic partisanship. We look at bone and joint health ahead of On Call with the Prairie Doc. Seth Tupper reports on the future of the Black Hills National Forest. Plus, SDSU takes down NDSU and snags the number one seed. We'll ask what's next later in the hour. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. Health officials continue to urge South Dakotans to get vaccinated. They also want to address any concerns the public may have. SDPB's Megan Feary reports.
Secretary of Health Kim Malsom-Risden joined Avera Health, Monument Health, and Sanford Health for a joint press conference about COVID-19 vaccination efforts in the state. More than half of South Dakotans have received at least one vaccine dose. Kim Malsom-Risden is the Secretary of the South Dakota Department of Health. She says the state is doing well with their vaccine rollout, but they haven't reached their goal yet.
Well, we want to see at least 70% of people age 16 and older vaccinated. We've got a ways to go to get there. Now that we have adequate supply, which again, early on was one of the concerns, there's no reason to hesitate.
Josh Clayton is the state's epidemiologist. He says that while federal officials halted the use of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine last week, that should not be a deterrent to get vaccinated.
Zero cases of the blood clot, CVST, have been identified in the state. No severe adverse reactions from any COVID-19 vaccine have been identified among recipients in South Dakota.
One concern raised was the possible effects of the vaccine on pregnant women. Dr. Heather Spies is an OBGYN at Sanford Health in Sioux Falls. She says it's perfectly safe.
The medical data shows that the COVID-19 vaccine does not affect fertility in women. There have also been new studies showing promise that women who are vaccinated during their pregnancies are passing antibodies to their babies. So not only is the vaccine going to help protect mom, but it is also going to add a layer of protection from COVID-19 for her baby.
Health officials say they want to do their best to answer any questions or concerns the public may have. But ultimately, the message was clear. Get vaccinated as soon as possible. All South Dakotans ages 16 and older are now eligible to get vaccinated. With SDPB News, I'm Megan Feary.
Authorities say embers from a homeowner's pile of burning debris is the likely cause of a wildfire that threatened Rapid City last month. The State Wildland Fire Division and the Pennington County Sheriff's Office investigated the fire. They say the blaze started at a residence on Schroeder Road. The homeowner had a permit to burn a pile of tree limbs and other vegetation. The homeowner thought the fire was extinguished. Authorities say they have not filed any criminal charges. The Schroeder fire burned more than 2,000 acres on the western edge of Rapid City. The fire destroyed a home, two outbuildings, and a porch. About 500 people were temporarily evacuated. The state of North Dakota has filed a motion to intervene in a lawsuit over the Dakota Access Pipeline so it can help defend the project. Attorney General Wayne Stengem filed the motion, saying the federal permitting agency that has defended the pipeline in court can no longer adequately represent North Dakota's interests. The state contends the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has abandoned its lead role in defending its decision to grant the easement for the pipeline's crossing under the Missouri River. That effectively puts the fate of the pipeline in the hands of U.S. District Judge James Boasberg. Last year, the judge ordered the line shut down, only to have that ruling overturned by an appeals court. For weather today, we're seeing mostly sunny skies across the state with a chance of sprinkles in the southeast later this afternoon. For SDPB News, I'm John Wynn.
And I'm Lori Walsh. Since 2014, more than 500 unaccompanied immigrant children have been released to sponsors living in South Dakota. The process is overseen by the Office of Refugee Resettlement through the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem has been speaking out against welcoming migrant children to South Dakota during the Biden administration. Joining us now for input is Tanisa Islam, Executive Director of South Dakota Voices for Peace. Tanisa, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me back, Lori.
So I want to clarify some differences here. It's not illegal to seek asylum in the United States. Explain to our listeners the difference between a person crossing the border, particularly the U.S. southern border with Mexico, illegally, and a child who shows up unaccompanied at the border seeking asylum.
Sure. I mean, this is a very complicated issue. First and foremost, U.S. law and international law allow for anybody to come to our borders to seek asylum, which is different from the refugee process. Even people who are inside of our country unlawfully, perhaps they crossed the border illegally, which I'll get to, or they've overstayed their visas, which is the majority of people who are unlawfully present in our country. Even they can seek asylum within 1 year of crossing into our country. So it is a mistruth to say that people who are coming to our borders to seek asylum is in any way illegal. Now, to understand illegal entries, it's really to understand what the process is at the border. When migrants come to our border, the overwhelming majority and over 90% of children are coming to a border checkpoint. That is not an unlawful entry to come to our checkpoint. They may not have permission to be in our country, but it is not illegal for them to come to a checkpoint. An illegal entry is when you cross not at a border checkpoint, you're not processed by Homeland Security in any way, and you just find yourself in our country, which is a very de minimis number of migrants that we're seeing at our border.
Governor Noem had accepted migrant children during the Trump administration, and she has said she does not believe the Biden administration has really secured this process, has control of it enough for her to continue that policy of accepting these children into South Dakota. What would your response be to that thought?
I think it's critical for people to remember that the Trump administration was not following international or U.S. law on asylum. By bottlenecking the problem in Mexico and making children and families stay in Mexico while their asylum cases were being processed in the United States, it was the Trump administration that separated children from their families as a deterrent, which has continued to cause havoc in those families' lives. So the bottleneck was in Mexico. These children that we see today at our border were staying in Mexico in inhumane and very unsafe conditions. The Biden administration has allowed for just children, just unaccompanied minors, those are children without family members they've traveled with. He is letting just unaccompanied minors come back into our country so they are living in safer and more humane conditions while their immigration process is going through.
Does that mean if there is a family who either has a relative who shows up and they want to sponsor a niece or a nephew, for example, that phone number was pinned to a kid's shirt, for example, or a family who wants to sponsor children maybe that they're not related to, if you live in South Dakota, is that on hold right now? How has the governor's policy, what kind of implication is it having on people's lives? And then I'll ask you about how her words have an implication on people's lives. But first, the policy.
Well, I'm not sure what policy Governor Noem has outside of the tweet she tweeted last week, which I don't consider to be a policy. However, it's really important to understand that state elected officials have no authority on how immigration law is implemented in our country because it is a federal system. And so children who come to the border, there is a very specific process on how long they can be detained and how they get to a sponsor in South Dakota. And that is now picking back up. You know, we are the only nonprofit organization in the state that provides free legal services to these children once they get to South Dakota because they are all in immigration court proceedings. We did see a drop off in those numbers because they were bottlenecked in Mexico. And now we're starting to see children coming to South Dakota to live with their sponsors and seeking our legal services.
And finally, the governor's words when she says, "Call me when you're American." How does that land on immigrant families in South Dakota and the people working on their behalf?
It's very disrespectful. At the very least, there are immigrants in our state for generations with different immigration statuses. If COVID-19 has taught us anything about our immigrant communities, is that they are our essential agricultural workers all the way to our essential healthcare workers. So that disrespect is we take very seriously.
Tanisa Eslam is the executive director of South Dakota Voices for Peace. Tanisa, thank you for being here today with some perspective.
Thank you for having me.
Ahead on In the Moment, we look at bone and joint health as the work of On Call with the Prairie Duck continues. You get your medical information from doctors right here in South Dakota. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
As the Derek Chauvin murder trial ends with convictions on all three charges, what does this moment mean for racial justice?
This can be a giant step forward in the march toward justice in America.
I'm Ari Shapiro, the legacy of George Floyd and the future of policing, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen, beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding with your support and by Gene Hufford of American Family Insurance on Jackson Boulevard in Rapid City. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly with Gene Hufford Agency Incorporated. GeneHufford.com.
A lot of businesses that survived the pandemic have some cash on hand and they are spending big.
Everything from a cabinet that takes individual sheet pans to larger chambers that you can roll multiple racks into.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. CapEx, capital expenditures, and the course of this recovery. Next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain on SDPB Radio. Underwriting SDPB Radio enhances your corporate image and projects quality and credibility. Stand out from the competition and reach a quality audience. Include SDPB Radio in your branding campaign. SDPB.org/support. Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The team of Prairie Docs carry on the work of Dr. Rick Holm and the Healing Words Foundation. On Call with a Prairie Doc, broadcast on SDPB-TV, is a way for South Dakotans to access science-based medical information from providers here at home. This week's topic is preventing, treating, and healing bone and joint injuries. Dr. Kelly Evans is an internal medicine physician with Avera Medical Group and a member of the On Call with the Prairie Doc team. I spoke with her this morning and asked her about prevention first.
This is no mystery, right? The answer is staying active and exercise. And in almost all cases, we know that weight-bearing exercise tends to keep bones stronger. So doing that, you know, lifelong is important to keep bones healthy, especially as people age and tend to have more issues with things like falls and fractures related to low bone density. And then, you know, injury prevention could be maybe another aspect just depending on exactly what type of activities a person does, they might be at risk for various other injuries. And I think this is a place that I really love to use our physical therapists and our occupational therapists to really assess an individual person and how they move and what they need to expect from their individual body and how we can help them prevent injury. So if your physician or healthcare provider ever suggests physical therapy or occupational therapy, I think by all means, there's really not a downside to that.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about falls and fractures. And I broke my ankle in March and just turned that ankle on the ice. And so what happens once that happens, especially as you get a little older, it's a whole lot different than when I broke my ankle when I was in fifth grade. I can tell you that.
Right. And you can imagine, I mean, so, you know, I imagine you've had to be what we call non-weight bearing mm-hmm. on that ankle for a long period of time. As people get older, that act in itself becomes more difficult, right? You know, most 80, 90 year olds that I know aren't able to get around with things like crutches or a scooter safely. So, you know, an injury like that leads to them being wheelchair bound, which is not what anybody wants. You know, most younger people can still move their other limb and bear weight, but just because of, you know, muscle weakness that comes with aging, having an injury that requires you to not bear weight on that limb to let it heal it causes, you know, other problems. So fractures, there's no matter what you do about them, whether they're treated with surgery or not surgery, they take time to heal regardless of the route that you take. So that recovery time can be tough for people.
Yeah, we're on 8 weeks now. And balance was the first thing I noticed. I noticed strength, but then I also noticed, wow, standing on one foot takes a little practice. So what can people do to sort of work on their balance in the event to not only prevent a fall, but in the event that they have to make some physical adjustments for an injury where that balance is nice and strong?
So, you know, balance is an interesting concept because there are a lot of factors that go on in our body, in our nervous system, in our brains that lead to good balance. And any one of those things being impaired can impair people's balance. So, for example, some people who have neuropathy or numbness in their feet, they can have poor balance because they can't feel, you know, where their feet are in space and the relationship to the ground. So that can be one problem. Certainly people with any type of neurologic disorder or brain disorder can have impaired balance because of issues that go on in the brain. And then muscle strength and joint stability can impair balance if they're not good, just because, you know, especially if you're trying to balance on one limb, those large muscles of the leg that you use to stand up out of a chair or take a flight of stairs, those, we really rely on those things to keep our body upright. And you might not notice that until suddenly you are using, one leg instead of two to do those things. So it can be a variety of things. And again, I say that the therapists are great at figuring out exactly what the major problem is and if there are things that we can do to try and help.
Sure. Talk about bone density. You mentioned that earlier. And at what age do people have to start thinking about whether or not they have problems with bone density? When does it start to show up?
It's a bigger problem of aging, but there are exceptions to that rule. You know, people who are on prednisone for some reason for a long time tend to have risk of lower bone density. Women who might have their ovaries removed and be, you know, deficient in estrogen at a younger age might be at higher risk. So there are various things that can increase risk of that happening at a younger age. But low bone density tends to occur as people get older, and is more common in women than men, but that's not true across the board. So, you know, sometimes we'll recommend screening bone density, which is done by something called a DEXA scan. And that looks numerically at bone density, but I always tell people, you know, if we're going to do something like a DEXA scan, it has to be what we call actionable. So, you know, there are some prescription medicines we can use to improve bone density and decrease people's risk of fractures. But, you know, across the board, not everybody wants to take a medicine forever to reduce the risk of a fracture when a fracture may be something that may or may not happen. So that's a really individualized conversation that I have with patients about bone density and fracture prevention too.
Let's talk about joints before we let you go. And that is,
sure.
We mentioned older people, we think of hips or elbows or knees or younger athletes who have problems and want to just, mm-hmm. Be active, but also would like to be active when they're older as well and don't want to mm-hmm. cause damage to some of those joints through overuse. Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about protecting our joints?
Yeah, so sort of joint protection, there are some things that are in our control and some things that are just out of our control. People will get wear and tear osteoarthritis. Some people will get that even if they do everything right and keep a healthy body weight and exercise and stuff like that. So some things are out of our control and we just have to deal with them as they come. But across the board, things that can reduce people's risk of having severe arthritis as they get older that might set them up for needing something like a joint replacement would be things like really keeping a healthy body weight and keeping those joints mobile. The more weight we carry around, the more wear and tear is going to naturally occur on our joints. So that would probably be the biggest risk factor that I would think of. It would just be staying active and trying to maintain as healthy a body weight as a person can across their life. But you're right. I mean, some people will get early onset of arthritis in the knees if they had an injury as a teenager and they might have had some cartilage damage with that. So, some of those things occur at random and are out of people's control.
Supplements, take supplements, don't take supplements.
Yeah, that's a good question. A lot of people are taking things like calcium and vitamin D supplements. And what I tell people for bone density purposes is if you can get your calcium from your diet, then that's actually better. We absorb it better from our diet than we do from supplement pills. Vitamin D, it's kind of a fad vitamin. And there's certainly some people who need it with low levels, especially in the latitudes of where we live, but not everybody needs vitamin D supplements. And then, I would say maybe the most common thing that I see people taking for joint health is glucosamine and chondroitin. And I would say that's something that there's really not any considerable risk of harm, but the evidence in human data is not great. So I don't necessarily recommend that for people across the board, though it's probably not harmful.
That's Dr. Kelly Evans. I spoke with her this morning. You can tune in to On Call with the Prairie Doc Thursday nights at 7 Central, 6 Mountain on SDPB-TV. Find them online at prairiedoc.org or search Prairie Doc on Facebook. Ahead on In the Moment, the Dakota Political Junkies are with us. We'll talk about some of Governor Noem's latest executive orders and tweets and videos and what they tell us about the state of South Dakota politics. You're on Listener Supported, SDPB.
Prince was not only one of the biggest pop stars of the 1980s, he was also one of the most gifted and original musicians, bandleaders, and composers of his generation. He received respect from jazz icons like Miles Davis, who compared him to Duke Ellington. I'm Carl Gerke. Prince died 5 years ago, and this evening on Jazz Nightly, we'll hear some interpretations of his music by guitarist Dave Stryker, The Bad Plus, trombonist Nick Finzer, and others. You can tune in at 8 Central, 7 Mountain.
Program funding by Arts South Dakota, the annual Arts Education Institute, Band Director Institute, and First Annual Choral Director Institute go online July 12th through the 16th with grad credit available. Register at artssouthdakota.org.
If you've got cabin fever, you could try asking your smart speaker to beam you somewhere else, but a safer bet is asking your smart speaker to play NPR. Listening to well-told stories can help you feel transported to where the action is happening, and it keeps you feeling connected. When you want to be somewhere else but can't, try asking your smart speaker to play NPR.
SDPB is here to cover what's important to you. Just give us a shout. Ask your smart speaker to play SDPB Radio. Join your friends and neighbors who keep SDPB strong, become a $5 a month sustaining member, and gain access to a library of hundreds of shows with SDPB Passport. Details at sdpb.org/passport.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Governor Kristi Noem speaks out about unaccompanied children seeking asylum. She bans proof of vaccine requirements through an executive order, and she says people today are addicted to being offended. That comes from a prayer breakfast she spoke at. Today's political junkies are John Schaff. He is professor of political science at Northern State University. And Tom Dempster, he is a former South Dakota state senator. And we're going to talk about Governor Noem's words and how they're landing in the nation and here at home. Tom Dempster, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Absolutely, Lori. Good to be here. Hi, John.
Professor Schaff, welcome.
And hello to you all. Thanks for having me.
All right, I want to start with some comments that Governor Noem made. First, it was a tweet that she released, and then she released a video that was very similar to her tweet, which, of course, amplifies her words even more and allows people like us to hear them exactly as they were broadcast. So here's a little bit of what Governor Noem said about immigration.
Hi, everybody. I'm Governor Kristi Noem. Now, today I announced that South Dakota would not be taking any illegal immigrants from the southern border. If you are trying to enter our country illegally, call me when you're an American. President Trump secured our border. He fixed the refugee program to keep out bad actors. President Biden has destroyed all of that progress. Terrorists have been apprehended at the southern border, and the risk to the people of South Dakota is far too great. Elections have consequences, and President Biden has made America less safe. That's why I'm taking this action to protect all of South Dakota. Thank you for listening.
That is South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem. And I want to start with you, Tom Dempster, because part of this was in response to the idea of having children who arrived at the border unaccompanied stay with sponsors that were in individual states. And that sponsor might be a family member whose phone number was pinned to the kid's shorts or something as they showed up at a border checkpoint. Now she's talking about terrorism and comparing the Trump administration to the Biden administration. Tell me a little bit, Tom Dempster, about, you know, from an overall context, her words on immigration and what they're trying to accomplish at this point and how they land with a national audience and here at home.
Well, Lori, I'm probably going to be pretty harsh with these comments. A year ago, when we were talking about COVID and when we were talking about the strength of our political leaders and their capacity to stand up to crises like COVID, I made the statement that one has the capacity to do that because you choose to do this public service out of love for your fellow man. And these are not words of love, in my opinion. These are words of even arrogance, hate. Last week, I had the opportunity of using a modern bow and arrow. Modern bow and arrow is a lethal instrument that is utterly remorseless in its ability to create a spasm into whatever it hits. Well, modern media, if you'll forgive the analogy, modern media is a bow and arrow in its ability to create that spasm, most especially with outrage media like Twitter. And the arrow here, as you can see from the national response, the arrow here hit its intended target. It's a spasm, it's attention, it's celebrity. And instead of talking about meaningful immigration reform, instead of talking about, well, maybe even Minnehaha County, that in the early 1900s, 33% of our residents had been born in Norway, instead of talking about the strength of our heritage and the importance of immigration adding to the strength and the growth of our country, instead it says, you are not welcome. I don't like you. You are not part of the American dream. So I respond fairly harshly to those words.
John Schaff, you have been with us before as we talked about the need for immigration reform and what's happening, you know, at the federal level. We talked about this during the Trump administration, certainly. As you see Governor Noem, you know, making a splash with this comment, you know, call me when you're American, which she tweeted and then said very forcefully in that video, which we heard the audio clip of. She definitely has something to say here, but it is an incredibly nuanced topic. From a political science standpoint, there are advantages to boiling things down to a bumper sticker size, you know, thing that can be repeated, and there are disadvantages of it. Help us sort out what the advantages are to her politically of boiling something down so concisely, and then where it, you know, how to John, to Tom's point, how it hurts people and where it could hurt her politically.
Well, one of the things that Tom intimated in his comments is that I think the audience for the governor's tweet and subsequent video is not really a statewide audience. It's a national audience. And so it lends credence to the notion that the governor has aspirations beyond the confines of the borders of the state of South Dakota. Otherwise, I don't know why she has consistently over the last handful of weeks been a critic of the Biden administration, which is fine, but obviously, you know, it is not entirely relevant to the immediacy of her job. And so obviously what she's trying to do is she's trying to, you know, if you're looking for a positive spin on it, at least from the point of view of Kristi Noem's own interests, is she is gaining, as Tom suggests, national traction and national attention. And there is that, you know, the old saying, there's no such thing as bad publicity. I think we all know that's not really true, but there's a certain mm-hmm. amount of truth to that, that the more she can gain attention, and part of the way that she is gaining attention is by attacking the Biden administration on various issues. This is one of them. And obviously the more heated you can make that rhetoric, the more simple you can make that rhetoric, the more it's easily understandable by people. And another thing that Tom is intimating is sometimes the negative reaction, if it's from the right people, is precisely what you want to inspire, because then you can tell folks that you've got all the right enemies. You know, on the other hand, again, what you're talking about, Lori, is that, you know, immigration is extremely difficult as an issue, because, you know, these you talk about the unaccompanied minors crossing the border. You know, they're human beings, they have rights, so we all have responsibilities. But then there's always the question of, well, if a kid from Costa Rica and a kid from South Dakota have the same rights, and it's true that they do, but the United States government doesn't have the same responsibility to both of those kids, and how do we adjudicate the fact that these are people with human rights, and we need to respect those rights. We also are a nation of laws. We have to respect our laws. How do we go about finding kind of the middle ground between both of these goods that we're trying to promote, respect for our laws and the human dignity of the people who, for better or worse, end up at our borders? And, you know, if we're not going to just send them back, what are we going to do? And these are difficult questions, and maybe in that case, because it's a complicated issue that has the potential to be incendiary, maybe the less incendiary our rhetoric, the better. And I won't be the first person to note that these people at our borders actually are Americans. They're just not United States of Americans. and so that rhetoric is problematic in and of itself. But nonetheless, I don't know that it's helpful when you try to reduce something that's complicated, and there is some amount of justice on both sides, and you do reduce it to a bumper sticker that maybe has as its motivation to create heat on both for and against.
Yeah, and to the point that we had earlier on the program with Tanis Islam, it's not unlawful for international law to seek asylum at the border, and there are international laws and treaties in place as well. But I want to, first of all the right enemies makes me happy that you said that, John Schaaf, because I've never thought of it that way, proving that you have all the right enemies. I think that's worth remembering for the future. Okay, so this is my question. It's kind of nuanced, and I'm going to wade into territory here, and Tom and John will help me out of it if I get stuck. If there was one thing that people told me about Governor or about Congresswoman Kristi Noem before she ran for governor, and they told me privately, is that she didn't understand complex policies. They didn't think she was that smart. And I said, well, wait a minute. Is that really how, you know? But that was some of the early perception. So my question is, when we see her continually coming out with these sort of, you know, very pithy bumper sticker, taking these complicated topics and boiling them down to things that kind of, you know, get people fired up and create that heat. When people start asking her those questions about what she really understands about infrastructure or about immigration, does she expose herself to really not to being proven in a national platform to not really understanding the issues at hand, and does that hurt her? Tom Dempster, do you see what I'm asking in that question?
I do. And I would suggest to whomever made that statement to you or whomever asked that question, and I think, John, you've said this, I think you've said this before, is take a look at what South Dakota Representative Kristi Noem has done. Mm-hmm. Take a look at what Congresswoman Kristi Noem has done with her stint in the House. Take a look what she has done to leverage that to becoming governor of the state of South Dakota. Take a look at even grudging respect that members of the opposing party have of her capacity to do her job or to be an outspoken governor. And that statement ought be one of respect rather than the question that questions her capacity. I think you better take a look at her capacity and say she is extremely capable.
John Chaff, you wanted to add?
Well, I agree with everything Tom says, and there's, you know, people can use their talents in various ways. And the times I've talked with Kristi Noem, even observing her, she's obviously a highly competent, highly intelligent person. There is a sense that one of the pathologies of our politics in our day is that it's performative. And so people are less interested in creating public policy or building up institutions than using institutions for their own performative interests. And maybe sometimes this is what politicians do, and maybe they do it too much. And some of the rhetoric that the governor engages in is an indication of this, because I think we've seen, you know, when she was in Congress and she, for example, worked on agricultural issues or issues of, ironically, mm-hmm. perhaps human trafficking, I think she showed that she's more than capable of tackling an issue, understand the nuance, creating legislation, getting it passed. And so that certainly shows a capacity. But you know, when we enter into electoral politics, sometimes the performative aspect takes precedence over the I don't know what the grunt work of actually passing legislation, which is really hard and isn't always pretty and doesn't always get you the attention that you get by being performative, as opposed to, I don't know, maybe a work, more of a workhorse type of a politician.
Interesting. Let's close with this idea that she said, and I don't think this prayer breakfast is the first time she said it. I think I've heard her say before that people are addicted to being offended, and other people say, well, if people keep telling you they're offended, maybe you ought to correct your tone and be a little more respectful and listen to what they're saying to you. But I want to circle back to Tom Dempster. When Governor Noem comes out and says everybody is just waiting for people to say something that offends them, if you were in her political advisory team, what would your response be to her about how she uses her words and how it lands on other people?
Well, Lori, I guess that's if I were on her advisory team, all you have to do is take a look at her quote spectacular unquote notoriety with respect to national news. Someone told me, I don't know this myself, but someone told me watching Fox News the other day that from that commentator, she was listed as one of the top three contenders for being president. If I were her advisor, presuming that is her intention, I would say continue to provoke, as you certainly have these last 6 months or these last year.
John Chaff, you wanted to add anything?
I think there's always, you know, as I've said before, sometimes when you're taking flack, it just shows you're over the target. And I don't think people need to turn being inoffensive into some kind of fetish. But at the same time, because if you are in a person of responsibility and you have to do things, you're actually not really doing your job if you're not sometimes offending people or making enemies. It means that you're not doing anything important if you're not sometimes offending people. On the other hand, offending people for the sake of offending people is a vice. and people can adjudicate for themselves. You know, they any politician, whether are if you're again, you're not doing a job as a politician if you're not offending some people sometimes. It would just mean you're a pretty white bread politician. But we don't want to be offending people simply for the sake of offending people, or be simply because it might gin up some kind of attention to us when we say something a bit outrageous.
Yeah. Gentlemen, that was a nuanced political conversation. I thank you for it. I really appreciate that.
That's
I enjoyed.
That's why they pay us
the big bucks. Tom Dempster, thanks for being here. We'll see you next time.
Absolutely, Lori. Thank you.
John Schaff, thanks as well.
Thanks, Lori and Tom. It's a pleasure.
Louisa Roberts is an assistant professor of anthropology and sociology at the University of South Dakota. SDPB's Joshua Heyer recently spoke with Professor Roberts about the concept of moral narratives and how our media diet can contribute to toxic polarization. As part of our SDPB spotlight on guns in South Dakota, here is Professor Roberts, in her own words, talking about how moral narratives can diminish civil conversations surrounding the role of guns in our lives.
So there's these different moral drivers. So it's not that one side of the United States is evil and the other isn't. It's that they're being motivated by different moral stories that are, again, are shaping their motivations. And this is being reinforced in today's age of polarization by different media outlets that people get their information from. These media outlets, I'm not saying SDPB, but many media outlets have these news stories that are appealing to outrage, and this is not. Those forces are exacerbating tribal tendencies on both sides of the political spectrum, and that's a huge problem because we as humans do have this tendency to think in terms of the in-groups and out-groups, and the people in the in-group are good, the people in the out-group are bad. Obviously, these are dangerous dynamics to be having exacerbated and activated within our political community. So there's really a need today for more respectful conversations across the aisle. So the in-group is us, it's we, it's the group that one identifies with. The out-group is they, them, it's the other people of the other. And in a situation like today where political divisions have become increasingly activated, people on the left and the right are seeing each other as the other. And that's very unhealthy, of course, for a democratic society. It's not too surprising that people would feel their personal security being threatened, you know, in the current circumstances of COVID and so on. But I suppose guns have become the symbol in the culture wars, where for one side, they're seeing it as causing problems, as being a dangerous thing that needs to be gotten rid of. The other side is seeing it as a symbol of personal liberty. And it's unfortunate that things have been framed in this way because it makes resolution of the issue very difficult. Both sides are interpreting things in a different light. I suppose if something begins to take on a deeply moral character, it's one thing if a policy agreement is simply a matter of policy. If that's the case, then people can negotiate, they can compromise. Oh, I'll give a little bit there, you give a little bit here. If people see it as a burning moral issue, it's not going to be so easy to negotiate, to compromise, which speaks to the need to step away from and attempt to de-escalate the symbolic, the cultural conflict.
That's Professor Louisa Roberts in her own words. You can find all our coverage of this month's spotlight topic, guns in South Dakota, on our website, sdpb.org/spotlight. Ahead on In the Moment, we look at the future of the Black Hills National Forest, and we're going to talk about that SDSU football team as well. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Tanya Mosley. A jury in Minneapolis finds former police officer Derek Chauvin guilty on all counts of murder and manslaughter in the death of George Floyd. Floyd, a Black man, died when Chauvin, a white officer, pinned his knee on Floyd's neck for several minutes last May. We'll have the latest from Minnesota in reaction to the verdicts. That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding provided by First Dakota National Bank, supporting the businesses and individuals with a dream and the passion and drive to make it a reality. What will be your South Dakota first? More at firstdakota.com/first.
I'm Jackie Hendry, host of South Dakota Focus. A recent USDA Forest Service report calls for decreased timber production in the Black Hills, and one sawmill has already closed. U.S. Congressman Dusty Johnson weighs in. Dr. David O'Hara shows how environmental studies students are changing the landscape of Augustana University. Plus, the next installment of our series, Good Neighbors. That's Thursday night at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on SDPB-TV.
Quality news reporting is more important than ever. Your financial support is more important to us than ever. Support radio that's important to you. Become a member of SDPB today. SDPB.org/donate.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. The next few years will shape the future of the Black Hills National Forest. The U.S. Forest Service is focused on writing a new management plan designed to prevent overcutting without killing a timber industry already in decline. SDPB's Seth Tupper reports.
Managing the million-plus acres of the Black Hills National Forest has always required strategic compromises. Terry Jane is a Forest Service researcher.
The Black Hills has had a long history of timber harvest, which has contributed to the resilience of this forest beginning in 1899.
Jane's recent virtual presentation offered insight into how history has shaped the hills. That complicated history involves land held sacred to the Ocheti Shakoween people as the birthplace of their nation. When the U.S. government broke treaty promises, settlers and miners flooded into the region. It was a time when loggers were clear-cutting ponderosa pine trees to build settlements and secure mining tunnels. In 1899, the Homestake Mining Company and the federal government saw that the trees were vanishing, so they came up with a plan. They agreed Homestake would pay to cut timber on the newly established National Forest. The government would decide where loggers could cut and how much. Today, the Forest Service still uses that system to sell logging rights in national forests across the country. Jane says that won't change.
It should always be considered as a critical component in forest management.
But she says the amount of current logging in the Black Hills is unsustainable. The forest is now at a crossroads, much like the one in 1899. This time, it's not just mining forcing the issue. Jane says it's nature recoiling from more than a century of human management. Over time, forests naturally thin themselves. Wildfires, tree-killing bugs, and other natural forces create space to let old trees grow bigger. In that natural system, grass and animals thrive. Jane says people have interrupted those forces.
Throughout most of last century, we thought disturbances were bad, and we tried to stop disturbances either by suppressing wildfires or thinking we could manage our way out of disturbances by harvesting trees.
Now, she says, that thinking has changed.
The past 100 years have taught us that we need to consider and integrate disturbance into forest management rather than trying to control it.
But for the Black Hills, the realization came too late. The forest grew dense with smaller trees. That made it easier for fires and deadly bugs to jump from one tree to the next. Since 2000, the Black Hills suffered the three biggest wildfires in its recorded history and its second biggest mountain pine beetle infestation. Millions of trees died. Meanwhile, Jane says logging continued at a pace that was determined years earlier,
which resulted in a double whammy.
The forest couldn't keep up, and the result is a drastic decrease in the number of trees big enough to harvest as timber. Jane says climate change could make things worse. It could shorten winter and make wildfire season longer. It could also help bugs.
Cold winter temperatures kill mountain pine beetle larvae. However, if the Black Hills gets warmer winter temperatures, this may extend beetle infestations.
She says current logging levels in the Black Hills National Forest are twice what the forest can sustain long term. So the Forest Service is coming up with a new forest plan. That plan could influence harvest limits for the next 15 years. In the meantime, the Forest Service has already cut back on timber sales for the last 2 years. The timber industry is already feeling the effects. Nyman Enterprises plans to close its Hill City sawmill in May. That will eliminate 125 jobs. Company President Jim Nyman blames the Forest Service for letting the woods get too thick.
We tried to tell them in the 70s, 80s, and 90s that you better get more capacity in here and reduce this inventory or you're going to have bugs and fires, and they wouldn't listen.
Nyman says big reductions in timber sales could force him to close his other two Black Hills sawmills in Spearfish and Hewlett, Wyoming. He says the resulting domino effect could wipe out the entire Black Hills timber industry and its 1,400 jobs. Nyman says the result could be no loggers to help manage the forest. He says the forest could then grow dense again, leading to the same problems faced now. While Nyman argues for continued logging, two environmental groups want a moratorium on timber sales. One of those groups has sued the Forest Service over similar issues in the past. The Forest Service does not plan to make drastic changes in logging limits while it works on a new forest plan.
We understand the significance of all that's happening on the Black Hills.
Jackie Buchanan is a deputy regional forester.
We don't want to, do a sweeping change and then have to come back and change it. So we're going to be very thoughtful, recognizing all the factors and all the parties that are impacted and the concerns that folks have around that harvest level.
There is one person already talking with many of the parties involved about potential solutions. South Dakota Congressman Dusty Johnson has met with conservationists, loggers, and the Forest Service. He thinks there are ways to save the timber industry without overcutting the forest.
Everybody loves this forest. Everybody acknowledges that a healthy timber industry is a critically important part of keeping this forest healthy. We can talk about jobs, and that's important, but we also want to make sure we get this resource long term.
Johnson says the Forest Service needs help overcoming chronic staffing shortages that make timber sales difficult. He says parts of the forest considered too rugged should be re-examined to allow logging. And he says there may be new uses for smaller trees. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Seth Tupper in Rapid City.
To access and share stories, visit the news page on our website at sdpb.org/news. For more on this story, you can also tune in to South Dakota Focus with Jackie Hendry as she explores Earth Day in South Dakota. That's Thursday night on SDPB-TV. Well, last Saturday, the South Dakota State University football team scored a rare win against North Dakota State in Fargo. The win allowed them to finish atop the Missouri Valley Football Conference during a COVID-forced spring schedule. They're the top seed as they enter their first-round playoff game against Holy Cross this Saturday at Dana Dyke House Stadium in Brookings. Matt Zimmer reports on SDSU Athletics for Argus Leader Media, and he joins us now on the phone. Hey, Matt, how's it going?
Great. How you doing?
I am well. All right. For people who don't follow the Jacks, because I don't know, we went to Augie. Tell us why this win is a big deal.
Well, it gives them the number one seed in the playoffs, as you mentioned, which means in theory, they have the easiest path to a national championship. And their level of football, the Division I football championship subdivision, North Dakota State has pretty much ruled the roost. They've won 8 of the last 9 national championships. And so I think most people expected North Dakota State to win that game on Saturday, but the Jacks went to Fargo, won the game. Now they have the number one seed, and they will not have to go back to Fargo in the playoffs, which has often been their undoing in the past. So certainly nothing is guaranteed to them, but if they were ever going to do it, this is the year, as their win on Saturday kind of set them up for a pretty favorable path.
Yeah, I'm not. I'm just joking about Augie. We got to get our little where you went to college jokes in when we can around here, Matt. So, all right. So this is also just a huge opportunity for bragging rights against a team that is very tough to beat. Why is this team this year so special for SDSU?
Well, a big reason is they've avoided COVID, you know, and not every team has been able to do that. They haven't had any positive tests on their team throughout the season. They've had three games canceled, but all three of those games were canceled because of COVID in their opponent that they were scheduled to play that week. So I think as this weird spring season has gone on and more games have been canceled or postponed or more teams have opted out, a lot of players, a lot of teams have kind of said, you know, the hell with this. This is a fake season. This is weird. And it has kind of crumbled. Whereas South Dakota State, whether it's a credit to their coach, John Stiegelmeyer, or their players or whatever, they've been able to say, no, we're going to take this serious. This matters to us. And we're going to keep, you know, making good decisions and doing the right things and staying focused on it. And after a month off, you know, no one really knew how well they were going to play on Saturday, because that's a long time to go in between games. But they came out and played very well. They've stayed healthy. They've stayed away from COVID. And now, like I said, they have a clear path in front of them to do something they've never done before.
Tell us who is on that path and how it might all unfold. What's next?
Well, they play Holy Cross on Saturday. They're a small private college from the Patriot League. Most people assume that should be a relatively easy win. Holy Cross has only played three games this year due to COVID issues. I wouldn't say it's a slam dunk, but a lot would have to go wrong for South Dakota State to not win that game. Assuming they win that, they would play the winner of Southern Illinois and Weber State. Southern Illinois is a team the Jacks have already beaten 44-3 this year. So in theory, that would be a favorable matchup for them if they were to win that game. And I should mention Weber State is 5-0, so that would probably be the tougher matchup. If they were to get past that round, they would probably play Jacksonville State. They're the 4 seed. I don't know a lot about them. I know they played all their games this year. They're 9-2. But I think, again, because of getting the number one seed, South Dakota State would be home for all of those games. So they would, like I said, no guarantees, but they would be the favorite for all those games. And if they can win all three of those, then they would advance to their first ever national championship, which will be held in May in Frisco, Texas.
Pretty exciting stuff to watch. The SDSU Jackrabbits open their playoff season against Holy Cross. That's this Saturday at 2 p.m. It's at Dana Dyke House Stadium in Brookings. Our guest to help us lead the way has been Matt Zimmer. He reports on SDSU athletics for the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. You can find his work at argusleader.com. Hey, Matt, thanks so much for being here with us. We really appreciate your time.
Anytime.